This special episode is from Lucy Hogarth. She's an astrophysicist and tells us how you don't need to be an ecologist or climate scientist to engage with climate activism, and how her late autism diagnosis has helped her to understand who she is, and how it helps to process the climate crisis, and why others might find it so hard. This episode was recorded in January 2021.
I started off always thinking I was going to be an artist of some sort. I never was very good at science or maths as a child. It was only really until my A-levels that I decided that I'd always had a fascination with astronomy in particular. I'll teach myself how to do the maths A-level and I'll sit it with everyone else. And I got 100% of it. Which I guess goes to show that people change over time, and I often think that the educational system tries to channel you. So I decided after that to take a PhD in astrophysics. I suppose it's always been quite difficult juggling the art side, which has stayed with me with that. It definitely feels like two competing sides. So I was diagnosed with autism at 20 years old, like many women being diagnosed later in life. Later diagnosed with ADHD as well. I'm used to seeing life from a very different perspective, and as I've got older, I've become more and more aware of how I work, who I am.
What made you think you weren't good at maths?
Oh, well, I was never very good at concentrating in classes very much. I would tend to go off into my own world. I tended to make out of pens and rulers, you know, pens have a little clip on the back. I used to make little aeroplanes out of them and be in my own little world. So I suspect not listening was sort of part of it. I think also being autistic with hindsight probably had an effect, that my learning process was different. And I think the way that classes were set up perhaps didn't really work for me that well. And I think my brain had changed quite significantly by the time I started to look at maths again.
Yeah, I had a similar thing at school, thinking that I wasn't particularly good at maths. And it was only later on in GCSE where I had coursework where the creativity behind maths really became a bit more clear.
Sure, yeah. When I had, as part of my degree, some lectures given by the maths department, frequently the lecturers would admit that they were absolutely awful at arithmetic, you know, wouldn't be able to do the basic times tables, and yet they were incredible theoretical mathematicians. So I think they are two different mindsets completely, and they do get lumped together when you're learning maths at a younger age. I did have a very inspiring art teacher, which I don't think she ever quite understood that. And I said that you inspired me to go and study physics. But what I meant by that was that she gave me a lot of confidence in my own ideas and being able to work on my own projects and being able to express myself in perhaps a way that I hadn't really experienced before. A lot of the art I produced for my A-level art was based on physics.
At what point did you think about joining XR?
I'm not sure if I quite believed them, that because I was just thinking, well, I'm a scientist. Surely I'd know if that was the case. You know, I should know that stuff. And I didn't. And then reading the 2019 UN report, I was completely stunned because they were right. They were completely right that I hadn't known for so long that this was an issue which was affecting our lives right now, and that if we didn't do anything about right now was going to be disastrous. It was the fact that XR framed the argument in a way that really made at least me question how I understood the problem. They made it now, and they were so brazen about saying the truth. They didn't hold back. Potentially being in big crowds during demonstrations was quite frightening for me, and it wasn't something that I did lightly. I did it in the end because I felt duty bound to do something, particularly being a scientist, I think, that I had some sort of, I don't really like the word duty, but that's how it felt in a way. I suppose as a scientist, you are committing yourself to a life of looking for truth and telling truth about an area. And I just couldn't reconcile in my head that I am willing to do that for galaxies and not for the future of mankind. That just, I couldn't reconcile that. So I had to go and do something. It really wasn't an option even. It really felt like it was something I had to do.
Not everyone in XRS and in Extinction Rebellion Scientists is an ecologist or an environmental scientist. How do you think the diversity is important within that group?
I think definitely in communication it's important. I think scientists tend to see things from a data perspective. And I think it's important to realise that most people aren't compelled by data. They're compelled by narratives and stories and emotions. You can just show a graph to people and say, oh, look, isn't it awful? As much as you like, I don't really think data is going to be the answer to getting more people engaged with the climate crisis. It's going to be stories and narratives.
Speaking about narratives, was there a moment in your life that you remember where you suddenly felt like you needed to deal with this?
Yeah, that increasing coverage of seeing so many people who were just giving their time to support change. It became increasingly difficult to say, why aren't I there?
I remember, personally, it was, I think I remember seeing an XR poster that says something like, why not? And I thought myself, yeah, why not? Why am I not a part of this? And I couldn't think of a reason. And because I couldn't think of a reason, I signed up. But over those 3 years, have you done a lot of reading off the back of learning about things that have come up through XR activities and conversations?
I've become mostly interested in the psychology of why people don't like to talk about climate change, or the history of why they don't like to talk about it. A couple which I've really enjoyed are Merchants of Doubt, which is about how climate change became a debate and how that debate was artificially constructed by people who saw it as a threat to the free market. Today we still have the impression that if you believe in climate change or are active in climate change, that you believe in socialism or have very left-wing views. And it's really interesting to understand the history of that, that that history was written back in the 1950s and 60s. Another really interesting one that I'm reading at the moment is Don't Even Think About It by George Marshall. And he talks about why people aren't talking about climate change, why it's difficult for people to understand the risks and frame it in their minds in such a way that compels them to take action. But I think understanding why people are silent about climate change is crucial in how we go forward. You know, why is it that people aren't all on the streets? How is it that they've framed climate change in their minds in such a way that it can be ignored?
Why do you think then maybe some of your friends or family don't want to talk about it?
There are a lot of reasons. The first one is social norms. A lot of the way that people excuse their behaviour or explain their behaviour is by saying that other people around them are not doing anything. If you say to someone, oh, isn't it awful that the government aren't doing anything about climate change? They'll say, oh, well, you know, China's not doing anything, India's not doing anything. And I think that's almost like a comfort blanket, creating a social norm around you so you're not standing apart as being more bad than anyone else. We're very good at assessing short-term risks. If I'm immediately in the way of a car, I can understand that risk and I can get out of the way of the car. With climate change, it's a bit more confusing. you don't know exactly what is going to happen, really. I mean, in terms of where it's going to be affected, how badly they're going to be affected, whether what we do now, how much of an effect that's going to have. And it gives our brains a way to say, well, there's doubt about this climate change. So maybe it's better for me to reap the short-term benefits of doing nothing. And then there's the political element. So that feeds into people's narratives as well as the slight doubt over where, when it will affect us. I think there's a perception that climate change happens somewhere else, especially for Western countries. I think there's an impression that it won't affect them, or they'll be protected in some way. I don't think humans are very good at understanding, or don't want to understand, that they need to protect others as well as themselves. Sadly, I think a lot of people feel that they're quite safe.
Do you discuss climate change at work?
I have done occasionally. Certainly before the lockdown, whenever people were, because scientists were always jet-setting all over the world for conferences, I would occasionally question that and say, yeah, maybe we could do a virtual seminar this time from our group. We don't need to send anyone out there. It would usually be met with silence of people, you know, looking at the ground and not really knowing what to say. And then there would usually be a person creating, as I said, that social norm around them of, well, you know, us going isn't really going to affect the climate.
But these are scientific guys, right? They really know all of the things that you mentioned.
Yeah.
So what is it about that group of people still not really grabbing this and doing anything about it?
It's a very difficult thing to understand how people can individually act knowingly that they're harming themselves and everyone else around them. I guess it's that tragedy of the commons idea that individuals can act to harm the whole. And I don't know if it's just become an unspoken rule that you don't talk about it and you don't think about it in our society.
Have you ever been called out for being contradictory in terms of flying or eating certain foods or doing certain things that have a high carbon footprint?
I think only by myself. I've become increasingly conscious over the last 3 years about things that I do. I'm pretty sure I will never fly again. I haven't flown probably about 5 years. I became a vegetarian because I found it increasingly difficult to excuse eating meat. I don't buy new clothes anymore. I only buy from charity shops. So I don't think anyone's ever called me out from memory, but I've definitely become more watchful of my own behaviour and calling myself out when I'm doing something that I think, maybe there's another way that's slightly less carbon emitting that I could do this.
Do you think that XR is a predominantly left-wing group?
From the people I've met, yeah. So I would say liberal, left-wing, middle class would describe, and white would describe the demographic pretty well.
Do you think, though, that means that people who are more right-wing would see XR as more of a political lefty organisation and therefore don't want to be a part of it?
Absolutely. I think it gives them a reason to ignore it, in fact, because we all see issues as framed within our own biases and opinions. If you're going to try and radically alter the way the market is running, you have to put in some sort of regulation. And I think for many conservatives, that is a very difficult concept. Climate change ultimately challenges the free market model completely. I mean, because it's saying the free market is destroying itself. It's a massive failure on a scale which is very difficult to comprehend to many who are believers of it.
Do you think that being an XR is going to make any difference?
It's a very good question. One that I've been struggling with a lot lately. You feel the urge to do something, but that doesn't stop you realising on a large scale, how many people am I actually reaching? And am I just talking to the converted all the time? I don't feel like there's an area of my life which isn't touched by climate change in some way. It's like the Australian fires. It just, once it starts touching your life, it just starts burning away at everything else.
How did the Australian bushfires affect you?
I was hoping, in a way, that even though it was awful, that it might be a bit of an awakener for people, especially Australia, actually, because they've been fairly reluctant to accept climate change. I mean, it's very difficult to say individual events are due to climate change. You can only say that those events become more likely due to climate change. I was hoping that the fact that they had decided to say this individual event is likely to be the start of more to come, that it might trigger people to realise, gosh, this is a now issue, and what if that's us next year? But it doesn't seem to. I often thought that the reason that Western countries weren't, or richer countries weren't, acting is because they thought it was not a Western world problem, and that it was going to affect places like Africa or the Middle East or Asia more, or the global south generally. Evidence is saying otherwise. We've had many events recently where rich countries and rich areas have been affected, and not just by fires, by flooding too. And I don't know if it's the belief of people living there, there's a kind of a community spirit of let's build back, you know, it's hopeful for the future. And maybe they just don't want to believe that this is going to happen every year.
Have you had difficult conversations with your parents about climate change?
Not particularly with my close family. I would say more with my extended family. I have. I remember it was the Christmas before COVID, when I was having a meal with my extended family, and they were talking about flying to the Maldives for, I think, the third time in a year. And I just couldn't really contain how I felt about it. So I challenged them about it. And I said, maybe you should consider going on holiday somewhere in the UK this year. There was that dead silence, as there always is when you mention climate change. And then I remember my aunt saying something on the lines of, China's not doing anything. Now, I don't see why I shouldn't go on holiday if they're all, I don't know, doing whatever she imagines is happening in China. I got so angry that I left the house. During the meal, I just couldn't deal with it. It's an argument I've heard so many times that people have said, you know, it's either China or India or whatever other country people choose to say is so much worse than them. You know, it has to start somewhere. We all have some sort of personal responsibility. The wealthy countries, the people who live in wealthy countries, individual carbon footprint is enormous. I found that a very difficult moment, and it definitely has had a shadow over my relationship with some people in my family since then.
And you say that your close family are more in line with how you feel. Do you think that was guided by you, or did they come to that conclusion themselves?
That's probably standing on my soapbox for quite a long time, I suspect, and they gave in eventually. I don't remember having any arguments.
Have you been to any of the XR protests?
Yes.
And have you had any interactions that are difficult with the public?
I had a few incidents where on social media through the scientist platform where there was a picture of me posted and a quote of something I'd said in a speech that got retweeted quite a lot. And it got a lot of very unpleasant comments. And that was my first experience of, I guess, trolling on the internet. A lot of very personal things about my appearance, and it was clear because I was curious to an extent, because I'd never experienced this before, that these people had just set up an account that day with the intention of just targeting that tweet about me and what I'd said. I guess on top of that, It has been generally difficult coming up against the police. I would consider myself a law-abiding citizen. Being up against the police and the police pushing you back from places and police generally approaching you is pretty scary.
And finally then, Lucy, if you went to a school and you gave a speech to some kids about climate change but you didn't want to worry them too much, what would you say?
The tools are there for us to avoid this. We just have to implement them. But I think to try and motivate younger people to be involved is to try and inspire them and say, there are all these people who are willing to, who can change it. We could do this. We could change the world.
And with that, Lucy Hogarth, thank you.
To give feedback on the podcast, or if you'd like to ask a question to one of the guests on the upcoming episodes on public health, food and education, please send me an email to tippingpoints, all one word, at imperial.ac.uk, or on Twitter with @PeteK_AQ. The feedback I've received so far has made this whole thing totally worthwhile, and I'm so glad it's helped people to feel empowered to push for change, and to know that there are others out there who feel like you do, and even to have those difficult conversations with those you love. Although making this podcast has been one of the most enjoyable things that I do, it's also been a challenge to make them alongside doing a PhD, and I'll be taking a short break to get on top of my research. The next episodes will be coming out from late April, after the April Rebellion. See you there.
Rebellion!